wanted to make the story keep going.
His mouth formed a hard line across his face before he spoke to the warden again.
Nice of you to show up just in time for the end.
The end?
The warden shook his head.
I will never understand why mortals treat dying like it's the stroke of an axe, rather than the slow steaming away of water in a pot.
If you're going to talk like a fucking poem, you can keep your mouth shut. You know, like you've been doing for the past 36 years of my life.
36 years is nothing.
Sure feels that way.
Are you saying your life was nothing? Because if that's the case, what a waste of 36 years.
Sorry to disappoint you.
Hart almost called him father, but it seemed like the kind of tetchy work of irony a child would have wrought, and he was a grown man.
Are you going to ask me why I left?
No.
Too bad, because I'm going to tell you anyway.
Fuck this.
Hart intended to hop down off the branch, but suddenly he froze, and not of his own volition. He could neither move nor speak. All he could do was sit and listen.
As I was saying, the warden continued,
and when he looked on Hart this time, his eyes did not belong to Bill. They were lit with a cold gray light, great voids as vast as an overcast sky, immortal eyes, a god's eyes, infinite and immutable.
I open the door for the souls who lose their keys or don't have keys to begin with. Always have, always will. Except once. Once I wasn't there, and it caused a few problems, 472 of them to be exact, but I'm getting ahead of myself. Everyone crosses the threshold, right? So I've always found it bizarre that mortals are unpleasantly shocked when they find themselves either dead or on their way home. I mean, death is everywhere. Everywhere. Flowers die, and mortals have to replant them in the spring. Leaves fall from the trees year after year and rot. Birds drop dead out of the sky. Their babies fall from the nest before they ever spread their wings. A beloved dog breathes one last breath and rips a hole in a man's heart, as if it were a surprise rather than an inevitability. How the fuck do humans manage to look away? And why do they want to look away to begin with? Especially when it comes to lost souls. Almost every time I open the door for one of them, they resist. They don't want to come in, when you'd think that out of all the souls of the world, these are the people who would be most grateful to come home. It made me wonder, what's so great about living that you wouldn't want to die? So, I dressed myself up in flesh and blood and dried it out for a while. And the first thing I discovered was that living hurts. There are so many aches and pains. I stubbed my toe. Do you have any idea how much it hurts when you stub your toe?
He looked at Hart, his eyes less eerie now, but Hart couldn't speak, couldn't move.
I kept getting hungry. I caught the flu and lay shivering in a hotel bed for 3 days. But there was something else that hurt more than a stubbed toe or hunger or sickness. I couldn't put my finger on what it was, but it followed me wherever I went. And even that paled in comparison to the suffering I saw around me. People begging for food or money in the streets. People who were so ill they could barely move. People whose dreams had been crushed by time and fate and all the horrible things the old gods had unleashed into the world. I thought, if living is this miserable, why wouldn't people want to leave it behind? So, I was about to give up and go home when I met your mom at Lennox's Comics and Games in Pettisville, Arvonia. Ever been there?
Of course Hart had been there. His mother had taken him every time they went into town, and though they hadn't had much money, she'd bought him all the Gracie Goodfist comics he could carry in his small hands. Not that he could tell the warden any of this. He was still frozen in place.
She was arguing with the owner about the god of war and the god of old hell. Of course, back in the day, it was just hell, but we new gods got rid of it, so. Anyway, they were talking about the old gods comic series, and they were weighing the merits of each character, which one was superior, that kind of thing. It was a friendly argument. Obviously, I knew more about the subject than either of them, so I weighed in, saying that the trickster is the most powerful villain, the one who caused more problems for humanity than any other god. I think she thought I was joking, because she laughed. I wasn't joking. But she had a gap between her front teeth, which some people think of as a fault, but to me, it made her lovely, perfectly imperfect. Suddenly, all I wanted to do was make this woman laugh as often and as much as I could. It wasn't love at first sight, exactly, more like a knowing. I understood then and there that I was going to fall in love with her if I stuck around. So I stuck around. And that pain I felt, the one I couldn't figure out, went away. Poof. Just like that. Hart could see his own hand writing the words on the page. Maybe there's a strange comfort in knowing that at least one person feels something for me. Of course, that hadn't been the end of the sentence. Even if that feeling could best be described as hate, his memory finished for him. And he remembered with a fresh stab of loneliness that Mercy hated him again. "We had 5 months together," the warden continued. 5 months. 5 months is nothing, even by mortal standards. It's longer than the time I got with Mercy, you fucking asshole. Hart frothed on the inside. "You're wondering what happened? Why I left if I was so happy?" "I don't care." The words were there on the tip of his useless tongue. But then he realized it was a lie. He did want to know. He had always wanted to know. "Yes," he said, surprised to find that he could speak and move again. The warden's eyes seemed almost human now, black pupils rimmed in pale gray. Hart's own eyes staring back at him.
"I left Grandfather Bones in charge of opening the door in my absence. Probably not the best choice, but it's not like there are a lot of gods of death to choose from. And the unknown god is, well, unknown. And the Salt Sea deals with a lot of traffic, if you know what I mean. Anyway, bless his heart, Bones is deaf as a post, and he didn't hear the shuffling footsteps of the souls who needed help. By the time he figured it out, there were 472 souls locked out of the house, and a lot of very pissed off gods. Grandmother Wisdom hauled me to the door by my human ear. That hurts worse than a stubbed toe, by the way. I didn't even get to say goodbye to your mother. And I didn't get to meet you either. Until now."
The god's single tear rolled down Bill's rugged face. He swiped at it and murmured,
"I forgot about tears. Stupid Salt Sea."
"Did you want to meet me?"
Hart asked, his voice high and light, a child's voice with all its unhidden fear and desolation.
"Fuck yes, I wanted to meet you."
The warden no longer resembled Bill at all. He was tall and lean, his face angular, his eyes an innocuous shade of blue-gray. And Hart knew this was what his mother had seen when she met a man named Jeff and fell in love with him. This was his father, and for the first time in his life, the notion didn't tear his heart in two.
"And you loved my mom?"
Hart sounded even younger now. The god's thin mouth curled up on one side.
"Sure did. Sure do. She's home now. She came home to me."
"I saw her."
"I know."
"I really miss her."
"I know that too."
Hart stared at his father, drinking him in, his heart breaking and stitching itself back together over and over. The sun disappeared over the horizon, and the stars blinked on one by one. The warden gazed on the world as if he could see all of it, well beyond what Hart could take in. When the god turned to his son again, his head moved in the opposite direction, so that it was his second face he showed Hart, with eyes as pale and colorlessly gray as the morning sky on a cloudy day.
"Anyway, All those souls wound up trapped in Tanria, which makes sense. They couldn't hang around in the mortal world, but thanks to me and Grandfather Bones, they couldn't enter the house of the unknown god when they were supposed to. So they got stuck in the one place in the world that's in between life and death. Thing is, a soul without a body gets very confused in the mortal plane. After a while, that soul thinks it's supposed to be alive and searches for a body to inhabit so that it can keep on existing in its own terrible way. At the time, there weren't any humans in Tanria, so it wasn't a huge issue. But when people started coming in, things got ugly real fast. We tried to round up the lost souls, but by that point, it was like herding feral kittens. And there wasn't anything I could do about it but open the door to the souls who died too soon, because I left my post 36 years ago and created the things I believe you call drudges.
I don't understand. Why couldn't you open the door and let the souls in too?
They wouldn't come.
But they came when I opened the door.
Technically, you opened a door. Your door to your home. Tanria was always where you were going to die the first time. That's why it was there, and whew, the drudges didn't like that. You're like a bridge, you know? Half human, half god. When you opened the door from the outside, you fixed what your dad fucked up.
The warden reached out, and when Hart didn't shrink from him, he put his hand on his son's messy blonde head, the reassuring heft of it like a benediction.
I'm so confused, Hart admitted.
Mortals usually are.
So the drudges have all gone home? There are no more lost souls in Tanria?
That's right.
And I'm mortal? I died?
Yep.
His skinny shoulders caved in, but he tried to be brave.
Okay.
The warden jostled him affectionately.
See? You're sad to leave like everyone else. So it wasn't a waste of 36 years after all.
Hart pulled away as a pressing question bubbled up from the depths of his muddled thoughts.
What did you mean about me dying the first time?
You get two deaths to die, little demigod. One from me, and one from your mother.
Doesn't that mean I have two lives to live?
Same difference.
His father hopped off the limb and held out his arms. Hart jumped down and giggled when his father caught him and tickled him. They walked hand in hand to the house with the music of cicadas wheezing a late summer song around them. They were nearly home when his dad stopped, knelt beside him, and pointed to someone in the distance.
See there? He came to say goodbye to you after all.
Standing in a moonlit field was a man holding a lamp in the darkness. It was hard to make out the features of his face from so far away, but he held up a hand with the tips of two fingers missing, a gesture that was both blessing and absolution. Hart held up his own hand in reply, and a heavy weight seemed to roll off him. He felt lighter than a cottonwood tuft, floating lazily to the ground. His father stood and nudged him toward the house.
Come on, off to bed with you.
Grandpa sat on the back steps, smoking a pipe, the sweet aroma filling Hart's nose with a scent of home and comfort.
Good night, Grandpa.
Grandpa tucked his pipe into his overalls pocket and patted Hart on the head.
Good night, Peanut.
Peanut. Hart had forgotten that his grandfather called him that. He grinned at the old man as his father picked him up and carried him inside. When they stepped through the door, Mom was in the kitchen, scrubbing a pot at the sink. She dried her hands on a dish towel when she saw him and smiled, a gap in her front teeth on full display.
Going to bed?
Hart nodded, his cheek smooshing into his father's shoulder. She smoothed his hair and kissed the top of his head.
Good night. Love you. Love you too.
He was so tired, he could barely form the words. His father carried him up the stairs. His head lolled, His arms grew limp around his father's neck. His legs dangled and swayed with each step up. They turned into the first room on the left, and Hart's father laid him gently onto his bed. Hart was already in his favorite pajamas, the ones with dogs all over them, although he couldn't remember putting them on, and his mouth tasted of toothpaste. His eyes drifted shut as his father pulled up the blanket and tucked him in, but he fought sleep. There was something he meant to ask, something he needed to know.
Dad?
Yep.
Why did the old gods go away?
Probably because infinity is a terrible thing. But you already knew that, didn't you?
Hart did know that. But infinity didn't seem as scary when his father was beside him. He nodded, and his father leaned down to kiss his forehead.
Good night, Hartley James. I'll wait for you.
Chapter 40. It was time to sew up Hart's wounds. Some undertakers skip this step, especially if the body was slated for cremation. Mercy had no idea what Hart's arrangements were yet, but only the Sol Sea could stop her from doing this for him at the end. Except, as she stood over him with needle and thread in hand, she couldn't bring herself to do it. If she sewed him up, she'd have to salt his body next. And if she salted his body, she'd have to say the incantations over him. And if she said the incantations, she'd have to wrap him in sailcloth. And if she wrapped him, she'd never see him again. If she did all those things, she would have to build his boat and send him over the salt sea to the house of the unknown god. He's already gone, her tired, sluggish brain begged her heart to understand, but her heart couldn't accept it yet. They're here. Pop stood at the door. Mercy set down the needle and thread on the table, grateful for the interruption, but reluctant to leave Hart, even if he wasn't going anywhere. I'll be right there. Her father left her alone with the body. Mercy kissed Hart's temple, then pulled his sailcloth over him as if she were tucking him into bed. She took off her sweaty headscarf, smoothed her hair, and made her way to the office, where she found her father, Alma McGuire, and a petite woman standing around the desk. I don't think you've met my wife, Diane, said Alma, more composed than she had been a few hours ago. Diane, this is Mercy Birdsall. She's taking care of our Hart. Our Hart. Why did he think he was alone, when clearly these two women loved him as much as... Mercy couldn't bring herself to finish that thought, or to say, nice to meet you, so she simply extended her hand. Diane bypassed the hand and dove straight into her, hugging her with bird-like arms that were stronger than they looked, arms that had probably hugged Hart in the same way. Gird yourself. She's going to hug you. A lot, Hart had warned her. Mercy had thought she didn't have any tears left to shed, but she was wrong. Hugging Diane felt like hugging her own mother, so she clung to the tiny woman far longer than she should have. And Diane, for her part, clung to Mercy as tightly, gasping with sobs as tiny as she was. Sorry, Mercy said when she could bring herself to pull away. You have nothing to apologize for. Diane took a handkerchief from her purse and dabbed Mercy's cheeks dry, though her own were damp. It's clean, I promise. A tearful laugh burst out of Mercy like the last, unexpected gurgle of a coffee percolator. She accepted the handkerchief and blew her nose. I'll wash it and get it back to you. Please, don't worry about that. You have more important things on your plate. Mercy knew that she was referring to the dozens of bodies that had piled up at Birdsall and Sun overnight. And yet, more important things made her think of Hart. And on your plate made her think of the prep table and the fact that he was all alone in the boatworks. She knew he wasn't really there, and yet the guilt of abandoning him lay thick and heavy on her chest. Pop picked up Hart's file from the desktop and glanced around at the three women crowded into the tiny office. Everyone ready? They nodded. But Mercy was fairly certain that none of them were prepared for this. How could they be? Pop shifted his reading glasses from the tops of his eyebrows to the tip of his nose and opened the file folder. Mercy caught a glimpse of Hart's signature at the bottom of the page, the strokes of each letter of his name created with his living hand. Diane's finger slipped between hers and squeezed, an acknowledgement that this moment was next to unbearable. Mercy was certain that Alma's hand was held in an equally tight grip. "He requested a boat in our Vinlandian series, made of teak, inside and out." Mercy's heart dropped as her father looked at her over the top of his glasses.
I've never made a Vinlandian.
You'll do fine.
And teak? He ordered teak?
Is teak bad? Alma asked.
No, it's the best material there is. It's incredibly expensive. Why would he order the most expensive boat we offer? That's so unlike him.
But in the question lay the answer. She hadn't closely examined the books lately, not since Lillian had begun the transition into the office manager job. But it would explain why Birdsall and Son was doing better than they ought to be. Clearly, that order alone had kept them afloat for the past 2 months. Mercy had refused to take Hart's money when he'd offered it, so he'd given it to her the one way he could. The lash of grief slapped her all over again. She pressed Diane's handkerchief to her eyes as if she could hide from the pain, and the fingers wrapped around hers squeezed more tightly.
"He requested that his remains be taken to the pyres and that the ashes be given to Alma McGuire and Diane Belinder."
Mercy let loose an incredulous huff. Leave it to Hart to order the most luxurious funereal boat money could buy, only to burn it as soon as he was inside.
"Did he say what he wanted us to do with the ashes?" Alma asked, her voice rough.
"He left that to your discretion." Alma nodded, and Pop read through the next line of Hart's funeral arrangements. "His mother's birth key is to be sent to his aunt, Patricia Lippitt, whom he believed to be residing in Pettisville, Arvonia. Do you happen to know his aunt's whereabouts?"
Alma took up her wife's hand and pressed a kiss to it.
"We can look into it."
"Good. As for his earthly belongings, including any and all assets and the contents of his bank account or accounts."
Pop tossed the file folder onto the desk, unfolded Hart's last will and testament, and scanned the document. He took off his glasses, rubbed his forehead, and looked his daughter square in the eye.
"He left everything to you, Mercy."
It was almost 9 a.m, and Mercy had been awake for well over 24 hours, so the words coming out of her father's mouth made sense one by one, but she couldn't seem to string them together in any comprehensible way.
"What? He left you everything."
Mercy wasn't sure if she could handle any more shocks, and definitely not one of this magnitude. In the silence that followed, she pressed her hand to her cheek, trying to wrap her brain around what this meant. Alma burst out laughing and clapped her hands together.
"Good for him.
Phew. Aunt Patty's not going to like that."
"Alma,"
Diane chastised her, although a grin played at her own mouth.
"That hag was awful to him, and you know it."
"Why?" Mercy asked. She meant, why me? Not, why is Aunt Patty not going to like this? But Alma answered the second question.
"It's got to be a small fortune. 1,200,000 at the time he created his last will and testament, according to the document on file."
Pop concurred with a numerical precision that stopped Mercy's heart.
"That kid never spent a penny on himself. Well, except to buy imported tea."
Alma's voice broke at the end, a sound that echoed the fissure in Mercy's chest. Diane stroked her wife's back, sniffling hard.
"I can't take it," Mercy said. "He wanted you to have it. You two should have it, not me."
Diane stood in front of her and took her by the arms, gazing at her with tired blue eyes lined with the kind of crow's feet that came from decades of sunlight and smiling.
"This is what he wanted. Let him have this, here at the end."
Mercy was saved from answering by a knock at the office door. It was Danny, holding his hat over his heart.
"Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt. Lil sent me to come bring you home, Pop."
"It's all right, Mr. Birdsall. Diane would like to say goodbye, and then we'll be on our way," Alma said, shaking Roy's hand.
Goodbye. The word was a blade in Mercy's chest. Pop turned to her.
You need to go home, too.
I am home.
You know what I mean. Go to bed.
I'm going to finish him up first.
Pop's eyes were bottomlessly sad. He's not going anywhere.
Go home, Pop, she begged him. This father of hers who had almost died a year ago. The sorrow of that near loss, mingled with her current misery, made Mercy cling to what she had left. She hurled herself at him, holding him tight.
I love you so much.
I love you too, Muffin. He patted her back, comforting his first baby.
Zeddy's still here if you need anything.
Mercy snorted as she pulled away.
Is that supposed to make me feel better?
He answered her laugh with a bittersweet one of his own.
You're incorrigible, the lot of you.
He left with Danny, and Mercy felt the crushing weight of the past few hours settle into her bones. She hadn't wanted to leave Hart's body in the boatworks. Now she wasn't sure that she was up to the task ahead of her. Diane placed a maternal hand on the side of Mercy's face, and Mercy couldn't help but nestle her cheek into its slender warmth.
I'm glad he had you, if only for a short while. And I'm glad he has you now.
Thank you, Mercy told her, grateful for the woman's grace and kindness. She was certain she didn't deserve it, not when it came to Hart. She pocketed the handkerchief and led Diane to the boatworks, where they found Penn waiting beside the door. His eyes were puffy, and he seemed older than he had been a day ago.
Can we make a deal that we're not going to hug each other? Because we'll both lose it if we do?
He asked her.
Thank you.
Yes.
Where's Zeddy?
He's asleep.
In my bed?
Sorry. It was late, and we both crashed.
I forgive you. Him? Not so much.
She was hoping to coax a small smile out of him, but he was as solemn as a shipyard.
I want to say goodbye to him, but I also don't want to see him. I don't know what to do.
I've got a sailcloth over him, Mercy told him. You could come in and say goodbye and see him, but not see him at the same time. Would you like that?
Penn nodded. Mercy opened the door and stepped inside.
Already the room felt emptier, as if Hart were much farther away from her now.
Diane followed her in, but Penn stood in the doorway for a long time before approaching the shrouded body on the table.
Would you like for me to leave?
Mercy asked them both. Diane squeezed her arm.
No, I'd like for you to stay.
Me too, said Penn.
Mercy stepped away to give them space as they stood over Hart's unmoving form. Penn's hands fidgeted at his sides.
Hey, sir. I came to say goodbye. Sorry if I do it wrong. When my dad died a couple of years ago, it felt like Grandfather Bones dug a chunk out of me, and I've been carrying around a giant hole inside me ever since. Dad was always there for me. He really listened. He taught me. Not the school stuff, but the life stuff I needed to know, like how to shave and how to deal with assholes and how to talk to a guy I liked. He was the man I wanted to be someday, and then all of a sudden he was gone, and I didn't have anyone to help me figure myself out. Until you. I thought I'd lost the only father I'd ever have, but now I'm losing you too, and it feels like losing a dad all over again.
Oh, Diane said,
and produced a fresh handkerchief for Penn. He took it, but he didn't use it. He coughed, fighting the urge to cry. Then he cleared his throat and kept going.
I think I'm part of the reason why you did whatever you did, which is what a good father does, I guess. But how could you leave me with that? I know I shouldn't yell at you when you're dead, but I'm pissed off at you, sir.
Mercy couldn't stand it. She put a hand on his shoulder.
He reached up to brush her fingers with his.
Can I see him? He said.
Are you sure about that?
I'm sure. I think I need to see his face to say goodbye.
Okay.
Mercy let go of his shoulder, pulled down the shroud, and stepped away. She already felt like she was invading Penn's privacy as it was. Diane's, too.
Wow. Mercy. This is amazing. How did you fix him?
What do you mean? I haven't done anything yet. She looked down. Hart's eyes were closed, rather than open and staring. His lips were scarred, but no longer cut. Then his chest moved, expanding in and out, the inhalation and exhalation audible.
Oh!
Diane breathed again, this time in wonder, and Penn stumbled backward. Mercy's heart hammered so hard she could hear it galloping in her ears. She pulled down the shroud farther, revealing Hart's chest and stomach. His wounds were knitting themselves back together, and his color was beginning to return.
What is happening? Penn demanded.
He's a demigod, Diane said softly.
So, like, he's immortal?
Mercy couldn't speak, but Penn didn't require an answer, not when he could see all the evidence he needed coming to life on the table in front of them.
He's alive? He's alive!
Mercy saw Penn dancing in her peripheral vision, but she couldn't tear her attention away from Hart. She placed a quaking hand on his chest. His skin was cool, but the flesh beneath was less rigid. She felt nothing. Until she did. One spasm of the heart followed by a long pause, then another beat, his life slowly but surely pumping through his veins.
Is there a pulse?
Diane asked, a note of sadness tinging her hope. Mercy nodded.
Oh,
Diane said for the third time. The two women held each other's gaze over Hart, both of them understanding that this was not what he wanted. But because neither of them knew whether to laugh or cry, they wound up taking turns dancing with Penn, spinning a dizzying polka around the boatworks. Breathless, Diane returned to the table, gave Hart a gentle nudge, and called his name. All three of them surrounded him, waiting for him to open his eyes, but he didn't move, save for the rise and fall of his chest.
I don't want him waking up on the table, Mercy said. Penn, do you think you can help me get him up the stairs and into bed?
Yes, ma'am. I'll get Zeddy to help us.
He smacked Mercy's cheek with a sloppy kiss and zipped up the stairs, his feet hammering on the treads as he shouted for Zeddy.
I'll tell Alma, said Diane,
exiting the room with less ebullience than Penn. Mercy turned her shining face to Hart, but a bittersweet taste flavored her happiness. He should be dead, but he wasn't. And she knew that this was his worst nightmare coming true.
Oh, heartache. I'm sorry.
She took up his hand, growing warm in hers, and pressed it against her heart.
And I'm sorry that I'm not sorry at all.
Chapter 41. His eyes were closed, and he couldn't seem to open them. He was aware of sounds around him, but everything was muffled, as if he were underwater, although the whoosh of his breath and the thundering of his heart were deafening in his ears. His consciousness wove in and out, sometimes in blessed darkness, sometimes surfacing into the strange state of almost waking. When he did surface, his body was so heavy that he could not move it. There was no sense of time or place or memory. Only drifting. A familiar softness enveloped him, above and below, smelling of comfort and contentment. Her, his mind whispered, unreeling the single syllable like the filament of a spider's web. He had the feeling that if he could latch onto it, it would pull him wherever he needed to go. Something wet and smelly lashed his cheek with nauseating, slurping sounds. He lifted his leaden eyelids and found himself nose to nose with the ugliest, sweetest dog in Bouchon. Leonard, he remembered. He groaned, and with superhuman effort, he wiggled onto his side, away from the adoring onslaught. His gaze landed on a small woman sitting in a chair, her head lolling to the side in sleep. His breath was thin and his tongue thick as he pushed her name out of his mouth. Diane? She didn't stir. He watched her breathe, heard the sound of air weaving in and out of her body in time to the wagging of the dog's nubbin tail.
"Diane," he said again, louder, his mouth beginning to obey his will.
Her eyes eased open. Then she startled upright in her chair, as if she were a marionette and the puppeteer had pulled on the strings.
"Heart!"
She rushed to him and pressed her hand to his forehead, the way his mother had when he was sick.
"How are you feeling?"
"Heavy," he said,
but that seemed like a woefully inadequate response. She cupped his face in her delicate hands and kissed his nose.
"Is Alma here?"
he slurred. He felt drunk.
"I'll go get her. I'll go get everyone."
She pressed her forehead to his, and Hart caught the scent of her bergamot soap before she relinquished him. She dragged Leonard off the bed and hurried out of the room, shouting,
"He's awake!"
when Hart had never heard her raise her voice a day in his life. His throat felt dry and crackly. He saw a glass of water on the table beside him, and it wasn't until he sat up that he realized he was in bed. Familiarity with his location mewled at the back of his mind like a cat that wanted to be let in. But all he could think of was how thirsty he was and how badly he wanted a drink. He reached for the glass and fumbled it, nearly knocking it over before he got a firm grip. He gulped down the water, cool in his burning throat, streams escaping on either side of his bottom lip and dripping onto his shirt. He put the glass on the table and frowned at the wet stains on the plain white cotton undershirt stretched taut over his chest. It was small on him. As a matter of fact, he didn't think it was his. The metaphorical cat of his memory continued to scratch at the back door of his brain with increasing insistence. Hart had hardly registered that he was not at Alma and Diane's house when Duckers burst into the room and tackled him onto the mattress with more enthusiasm than Leonard. Hart groaned as Alma's familiar voice barked,
"Get off him, you dolt! He's not gonna break. The man's unbreakable."
Duckers smiled down at him before helping him set up again. Hart scanned the familiar faces hovering over him. Duckers, Alma, Diane, and Zeddy Birdsall?
"This is Mercy's apartment," he said as the blood drained out of his cheeks.
"That's right,"
Alma smiled at him. Why on earth would she be smiling at a time like this?
"I'm not supposed to be here."
"Where's Mercy?"
Diane asked Zeddy.
"In the boatworks."
Alma grabbed him by the arm and ushered him out of the bedroom door, Mercy's bedroom door.
"Well, go get her."
"Oh, right."
Off Zeddy went to fetch the last person in the world Hart was supposed to see. He flung off the blanket and stood on unsteady feet. Suddenly, everyone had their hands on him, and he found himself in a sea of "no, no, no," and "lie down," and "you've been out for 3 days.
"I have to get out of here,"
he insisted at the same frenzied moment that he realized he was wearing nothing but the white undershirt and a pair of boxer shorts a size too small, covered in tiny hot dogs. Definitely not his.
"Where are my clothes?"
No one would listen to him. They kept trying to convince him that he should stop or sit or lie down or listen as the cacophony of his own alarm spun in his head and came tumbling out of his mouth.
"I have to go."
"Hart, calm down. I'm not supposed to see her. If you would—"
He yanked himself free of their hands, and his calves smacked painfully against the bedframe.
"I can't see her."
"Hart?"
His name spoken from that mouth sliced through the noise. Everyone fell silent, Hart included. Mercy stood in the doorway of her own bedroom, with Zeddy shuffling nervously behind her. She wore the blouse with the yellow flowers printed on it, her dungarees riding high on her waist, her hair wrapped up in a yellow scarf. Her red glasses were a smidge crooked on her nose. Hart froze as their eyes locked across the room. His heart had barely begun to mend, and seeing her now was like ripping open the wound all over again. He stood there, inexplicably wearing someone else's underwear, unable to mask how raw and broken he was, while too many people were there to witness how much it hurt him to see her. Only then did it finally occur to him to wonder how he'd wound up half-naked in Mercy's bedroom in the first place, because he was 99% certain that it had nothing to do with sex. There was no earthly way he would forget making love to Mercy. Mercy, who looked at him with an emotion he couldn't identify. It wasn't anger, but it wasn't joy either. "Do you remember what happened?" Alma asked him, touching his arm in a tender way that was very un-Alma-like. He shook his head, although, truth be told, he wasn't trying too hard to remember. He was pretty sure that recalling the events that had landed him at Mercy's apartment in a strange pair of underwear would be a bad idea. "Let me talk to him," said Mercy. And to Hart's dismay, everyone obediently shuffled out of the room, leaving him alone with her. He didn't know what to say, and apparently she didn't either. The silence screamed between them. "I'm sorry," he said at last, directing his words to the hooked rug at his feet. "I know I shouldn't be here. I'll leave, just need my, clothes."
"We had to incinerate them."
"Oh." He was more and more certain that he didn't want to remember what had happened, and the fact that it had led to the incineration of his clothing strengthened that resolve. "I have extras in the hold of my dock," he offered, his desperation to escape tinting every word.
"You left your auto duck at the North Station. Zeddy and Penn are going to drive up to get it tomorrow."
The North Station? Why was his duck there? His memory caught up to him in fractured bits and pieces. The resolve to open the door, gearing up at the North Station, salt liquor, the field, the fight, the pain, the lost souls of Tanria flying around him and through him, his body dropping as the door slammed shut. "I died," he said. His face felt numb.
"Yes."
"I'm dead."
"No."
His attention snapped to her face. Her eyes were red-rimmed behind her glasses, as if she'd been crying or was about to cry, a pitying look. He didn't think he could handle her pity. He wanted to run from the room, from her and that terrible compassion. But she stood between him and the door, so he stared at the rug again.
"I know this is the last thing you wanted," she said. "But I hope it's some comfort to know the truth now."
"What truth?" Hart repeated hollowly.
"That you're immortal."
He nodded absently, and then he remembered everything. Everything. His mother, and Grandpa, and Gracie, and Bill, and all the places he thought of as home. He remembered the warden, his father, talking to him on the branch of a maple tree. He remembered the feel of his father's warm hands and gentle kiss as he tucked Hart into bed with the promise of 2 deaths to die and 2 lives to live. He let his gaze drift to Mercy's face once more. He understood her pity now and was touched that she cared enough for him to feel sorrow on his behalf, especially when it was a worry he could dispel for a change. "I'm not immortal."
"Hart, you were dead, and now you're not."
He almost told her everything, but what was the point? He had his life back, but he'd still have to live it without Mercy. In the end, he simply said, "I know. You have to trust me on this one. Not that I've given you much reason to trust me." He watched her forehead furrow in confusion, an expression so sweet that he let himself enjoy it for a second before he said, "I'll get out of your hair. I'm sure Alma and Diane can give me a ride to their place."
"You can't leave."
"I think it's for the best." She marched straight at him, and his heart jumped in his chest. His whole body went rigid with expectation, although he had no clue what exactly to expect. A slap across the face, a punch to the stomach, a kick to the nuts, a kiss. She yanked open the drawer beside the bed, pulled out a piece of paper, and held it up for him to see. "Dear friend, strike that. My dearest, strike that. Mercy." He wanted to howl at the bride of fortune,
but it wouldn't change the fact that the letter was in Mercy's hand now, that she had read his words and seen his heart in a way that he could never take back or hide, and it made him feel like the skin had been peeled off his flesh.
"But my clothes were incinerated," he said helplessly,
his eyes riveted to the brutal honesty of his own words.
"The truth is that if anyone bothered to scratch my brittle, craggy surface, they would find that my heart and soul belong entirely and completely to Mercy Birdsall."
"And then Killam fished it out of your vest and delivered it before we burned your clothes. A rabbit."
"Basarius. Fuck," Hart uttered.
He turned away from her and gripped the headboard of her bed.
"I'm sorry."
"For what?"
"For everything."
"I need you to be more specific than that." He could feel her eyes boring into his back.
"I'm sorry I didn't tell you about the letters."
Another savage pause followed his apology.
"You are failing miserably at this, so I'm going to help you out. Let me tell you exactly why you should be sorry."
The fury in Mercy's voice was so acute that Hart braced himself.
"You should be sorry that you thought I wouldn't eventually forgive you for not telling me about the letters. You should be sorry that you couldn't push past what I said in anger and come talk to me. You should be sorry that you put yourself in danger when the people who love you would rather keep you here. You should be sorry that you went and saved the world and got yourself killed in the process and left me here without you."
"I'm sorry," he sobbed.
"I don't want to hear I'm sorry, Mercy, or I don't deserve you, Mercy, or I hope you find someone else, Mercy. I want to hear I love you, Mercy."
She slammed the letter onto the bedside table and gasped for air. Hart let go of the headboard and turned to stare at her, dumbfounded, before he found his words.
"Well, of course I love you, Mercy. Was that up for debate?"
She burst into tears.
"For the love of the Mother of Sorrows, would you hold me, please?"
Hart obeyed, his movements jerky and mechanical, as he wrapped his arms around her. But holding Mercy was the same thing as coming home, and he drew her in closer and tighter, feeling her warmth against him, breathing in the pine scent of her hair.
"Please don't make me let you go," he whispered.
"If you ever let me go again, I will strangle you."
Mercy kissed him, and he thought he might fall to his knees.
"I love you," she said against his lips.
"Gods, I love you too. So much."
He kissed her and tried not to get snot or tears on her face. Then again, she was crying too, and he didn't think he'd mind her snot or tears in the slightest.
"Oh, that's sweet," a familiar voice said behind him.
Hart turned to glare at Basarius, who was, for reasons Hart could not begin to fathom, staring at him and Mercy through the open doorway, alongside Alma, Diane, Duckers, Zeddy, and an owl, all of them grinning.
"Isn't that the cutest fucking thing you've ever seen?" Basarius asked the rest.
"It is," Zeddy agreed with an obnoxious smirk.
"Nice boxers, Ralston."
"This is Zeddy's underwear, isn't it?"
Hart asked Mercy under his breath.
"We were desperate."
The owl primly clapped his white wings.
"Brava and bravo! What a marvelous finale! I do enjoy a happy ending."
"I want to remind you that I totally called this, sir," Duckers chimed in.
Basarius blew his nose into his handkerchief.
"Fucking beautiful," he wept.
Epilogue. Hey! Hart waited until he had the attention of the two adolescents, the charcoal in their fingers dusting their guilty hands. As they took in his 6 feet and 9 inches, his gray demigod eyes, and his sheriff's badge winking sunlight at them, they looked like they might literally shit themselves.
Gods, this job was fun sometimes.
One of them, the girl, was smart enough to run. The boy remained pinioned in place by Hart's icy glare. Girls were always smarter than boys.
What do you think you're doing there? Hart asked him. The kid was so scared that the charcoal tumbled from his hand out of pure terror as Hart loomed over him and regarded the boy's handiwork on the exterior wall of the schoolhouse. Miss Sanderson is a Bictha.
Miss Sanderson may be a Bictha.
He pronounced the word exactly as it was spelled, Bictha. But the poor woman's got her work cut out for her if she has to teach you lot how to spell bitch right. Hart picked up the charcoal, crossed out Bictha, and demonstrated the proper spelling in his neat, blocky print. Then he chucked the charcoal and leveled the boy with his steeliest glare. The kid whimpered.
Let's go say hi to your dad, Thomas, and see if he'll let us borrow a bucket of soapy water and some rags so that you can clean this up.
Hart oversaw the whole endeavor, from Thomas's father's excoriation of his son to the boy's cleaning of the besmirched clapboard. Toward the end, Hart relented and let his dog Trudy go over to the kid for a pet. When Thomas was finished, it was time for Hart to head home. En route, he stopped to watch the workmen take down the sign at Cunningham's funeral services with smug satisfaction. Mercy's coordination with the other undertakers along the border, combined with her investigation into the undertaker's shady practices, had put Cunningham out of business and into jail. Hart was so proud of Mercy, he could hardly see straight. And privately, he was thrilled that Nathan McDevitt's involvement in arresting Cunningham had led to Mercy's ex pursuing a career with the FICBI, the Federated Islands of Cadmus's Bureau of Investigation, far away from eternity. A sharp bark pulled his attention away from the defunct undertaking business. Trudy wiggled her butt, knowing she was supposed to sit as instructed, but losing patience quickly. The second Hart met her slightly bugged eyes, her thick tail thumped the ground.
Ready to go, Trudy True?
He asked his comic book superhero sidekick, named for Gracie Goodfist's best friend. The metronome of her tail increased its tempo dramatically. She was short but stocky, with the kind of barreled ribcage Hart liked to pat with a satisfying thump.
Come on, then.
She walked at his side like his shadow, her tail always moving, her mouth a constant smile as they headed to Mercy's undertakings, passing by the family home on the way. Roy was sitting in a rocker on the front porch, whittling a boat. When he wasn't whittling boats, he could frequently be found taking naps with Emma Jane. It was the cutest thing Hart had ever seen. Trudy ran ahead of him to receive the affection that was due to her from her human grandfather.
Aye, Sheriff,
Roy called as he set down his knife and ran his big hand over Trudy's adoring head.
Hey, Pop, remember there's a barbecue tonight at Alma and Diane's. Between all you kids, I've already been reminded 7 times. Zeddy's made roughly 20 side dishes and cookies.
Hart lit up.
Snickerdoodles? I think so, but he won't let me eat any.
Brutal, Hart commiserated before stepping inside to steal one. He ducked into the kitchen, where the plate of snickerdoodles sat on the counter. Zeddy and Duckers were too busy making out against the icebox to notice that Hart was standing there eating one.
Shouldn't you be working? He asked his former apprentice.
Duckers continued to keep his lips locked with Zeddy's as Zeddy flipped Hart the bird behind his back.
Barbecue tonight at Alma and Diane's, Hart reminded them as he took another bite. Bring these.
Duckers finally pulled away from Zeddy's mouth.
No offense, sir, but please go away.
You know you can call me Hart now, right, Duckers?
You know you can call me Penn now, right, Hart?
Hart considered this as the taste of cinnamon lingered on his tongue.
Nope, can't do it. You're as bad as Mercy,
Zeddy groused, as he grabbed Ducker's hand and led him toward the staircase.
Thank you. Hey, sir, I spotted a dragon flying over Sector W-13. No joke,
Duckers called over his shoulder as Zeddy dragged him up the stairs. Hart had to raise his voice to be heard as the two young men went into Zeddy's bedroom and closed the door.
Salt fucking sea, how many times do I have to tell you there are no dragons in Tanria?
Duckers snickered loudly behind the door. Hart shook his head, but he was laughing too. On his way out,
Hart patted Roy on the shoulder and handed him a pilfered cookie before heading home. A half block from Mercy's undertakings, he caught up to Danny, who was pushing Emma Jane in a stroller up the boardwalk.
Ready for ribs?
I am ready for any meal I don't have to cook or clean up, Danny said.
Trudy stuck her nose in Emma Jane's face. The baby laughed, revealing all two of her bottom teeth. Hart reached into the stroller and picked her up. She loved it when Uncle Hart swept her into his arms, because he made her taller than everyone else. He kissed her neck, her tickle spot, and made her screech with laughter.
Would you like me to collect your wife? Hart asked Danny when they arrived at Mercy's undertakings.
By all means. Come on, Emma Jane, little bottom.
He carried the baby inside with him, bouncing her and her dark curls as they walked through the lobby, the music from Mercy's transistor filtering in from behind the closed boatworks door. Leonard lifted his head from his favorite chair and wagged his nubbin.
Leonard, get down, Hart ordered him.
But when Trudy hopped into the other chair, he gave it up as a lost cause. He popped into the office, where Lillian was tidying up her desk.
Look what I found, he said.
There's my baby girl,
Lil held out her hands, but Hart hugged his niece to his chest and tickled her fat belly, making her giggle. That giggle was the best sound in the world.
I'm sorry, ma'am, but possession is 9/10 of the law, Hart said in his best sheriff's voice.
The baby screwed up her face as a horrid squirting sound came from her diaper. An equally horrid stench followed it. Hart handed Emma Jane to her mother forthwith.
Here you go, she's all yours.
He barely darted out of the way as Lillian swiped at him with one hand while clutching Emma Jane with the other.
Your mother is a terrifying woman, EJ, he informed his niece.
At least I don't look like a charcoal pit.
Hart glanced down at his shirt and frowned at the black streaks.
Good point.
He left Lillian to deal with the baby and the diaper and headed upstairs. When he stepped into the apartment, he dipped his hand in the blue-flowered bowl of salt water next to the door and touched his mother's key on the altar. He changed his shirt and combed his hair before heading downstairs in time to see Horatio and Bessarius stepping onto the dock.
Hello,
Horatio hooted, hoisting his driving goggles up on his forehead.
Hiya, asshole, said Bessarius.
I thought you weren't due back until tomorrow.
Darling, we are so much better at escorting the dearly departed to their final catafalques than our human counterparts,
Horatio drawled as he headed straight for the new icebox on the dock and retrieved a bottle of Veuve Didier sparkling wine.
And the pay is far superior to that of the Federated Postal Service. It keeps one motivated, does it not, Bassy?
Bessarius grabbed the whiskey bottle sitting on top of the icebox and pulled out the cork with his teeth.
If he calls me Bassy one more time, I'm going to shove this bottle up his ass.
Hart took his watch from his pocket and saw that it was nearly time to leave.
There's a barbecue at Alma and Diane's tonight, if you want to go.
Then M'Killam burst into hysterical laughter.
He thinks we want to go to a mortal party, Horatio chortled.
Loser.
You're fired, Hart told them both, which made them laugh harder. He shook his head, but he was smiling as he headed for the boatworks. The volume of the music rose sharply when he opened the door and found Mercy counting urns in the supply closet. She wore her yellow dress, the one she had been wearing when Hart stepped into the lobby of Birdsall & Son years ago and nearly blew it with the love of his life, or the love of his lives, as it were. He took her by surprise, sweeping her into his arms and dancing her around the boatworks.
You scared me to death,
she half laughed, half protested, as he moved her through an anchor step, spun her out, then brought her into him again, dancing in time to the music. She smacked him on the chest in exasperation.
Most people start with hello.
He bent down to kiss her.
Hello, Merciful.
She smiled at him, dimples and all.
Hello, sweetheart.
This has been a Hachette Audio production of The Undertaking of Hart and Mercy.
written by Megan Bannon. Read by Michael Gallagher and Roshni Lamino. Production supervised by Janae Harvey. Produced by Lepton Productions. Post-production by Lepton Productions. The Undertaking of Heart and Mercy is also available in print and as an ebook from Orbit, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2022 by Megan Bannon. Audio production copyright 2022 Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. Fiction. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.